Hello, welcome to another edition of Historical. With me, Matt Nelson, and my co-host, Wayne Bridgman.
Hello, listeners.
Yes, today we're going to take you on a fascinating and often deadly peekaboo at some of the ancient brands of special forces.
Wow.
Yes, and if that were not enough entertainment for you...
Well, we don't know that yet, but carry on.
Probably won't be. We will also be ranking them at the end. So you can consider who will be the top 10. We do not want to do these great warriors a disservice, so we'll be spending quite a bit of time discussing each.
Like their weapons, yep. Tactics, armour, how they came into being.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
Yes, and so this will be a 2 or 3-parter. Now, if you want to contact us, before we get into the cut and thrust, literally, of this podcast, if you want to contact us, you can now email us on historical@hotmail.com.
Just to say that the historical part of the historical@hotmail.com is two O's at the end there on historical. You see what we've done
yes,
there?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's historical@hotmail.com. Yeah. So please don't hesitate to contact us with suggestions for future subjects.
Yes, yes. In hindsight, maybe we would have put an easier naming convention for our podcast, yeah. But we're generally pretty happy
and
with it.
And to be honest, just an apology, we probably shouldn't have waited to after our first year of operating as podcasts to actually give you an email address that you can use to contact us. So I'm sure all of your questions and suggestions are just lining up, so feel free.
Yes, yes. And don't forget, we do have the Instagram and the Twitter feed, Historical Pod. Right, so Wayne, tell us more about this podcast,
Well, it's important, Matt, to point out that there is actually, just to set the scene here, a difference between those forces that are thought of as special, such as those whose names echo down throughout the annals of history of warfare, Matt.
Yes. Like the Spartan Hoplites, the Praetorian yeah. Guard.
Yeah, yeah, such as those. Yeah. And those units which are considered...
Alexander's... is cavalry guys.
You mean Alexander's companion cavalry?
That's the guys.
Not to do their memory a disservice or anything. Such as those, and units which are considered to participate in special operations. So let's translate that to modern day terms first, so we can set out the lines on what we're looking at here. So to start with, how would you, Matt, define the term special forces today?
Well, it's a good question. Depending on the country, and it's a broad remit. Firstly, special forces may perform some of the following specialisations.
Let's hear some examples.
Airborne operations.
Yeah.
Counter-insurgency.
Of course.
Counter-terrorism.
Same thing, really.
Covert ops.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Direct action.
Yes.
Hostage rescue.
Yes.
Taking out high-value targets.
Very, very important. Very important sniper, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Intelligence gathering operations.
Okay.
Critical, possibly Brilliant. The most important part. You need to know intelligence about your army to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Mobility operations.
Yeah.
And unconventional warfare.
Of which all the above are.
Sabotage. So, demolition.
Okay, right. So I think that covers it, Matt. So the term special forces in the US today, for example, refers to the US Army's special forces... like Navy SEALs, that sort of thing. We all know what they are. But special operations forces actually refers to all units.
Right.
But in Russian-speaking countries, what are they called there, special forces?
The Spetsnaz.
Yeah, with exactly that accent. And that is an acronym for special purpose. Likewise, Russian speakers refer to special forces nations as Spetsnaz.
Yes.
Or other nations.
So, for example,
US Special Forces would be referred to as Amerikansky Spetsnaz. In Russian, again, there's the accent for you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love it. So now, in a historical context, so back in time, we'll be referring to Special Forces as units which have played an important role militarily when the aim has been to achieve disruption or to gain an advantage by either hit-and-run tactics... pure shock and terror, sabotage and surprise, rather than more traditional, conventional army combat, such as a phalanx and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, so just to finish laying out the rules for our top 10, we won't be discussing the rank and file elite troops, like the Spartan Royal Guard, the Immortals, or Roman Extraordinarii.
Yes, yeah.
who had the dubious honour of marching at the front of the army, Matt.
Yeah.
As these units are something for their for future podcasts, really, and we're looking at the smaller, more unique units, shall we say. Nor will we talk of the troops accountable for devastating battlefield casualties, such as the English longbowmen, some of our favourites, Matt.
Yeah, because
Alexander's cavalry guys.
Yeah.
Or Mongol horse archers. No, this podcast will bring back to life some of the more unusual specialised units in history, Matt. Intriguing, isn't it?
Yes, now, we have a lot of ground to cover, which means we will be splitting this podcast into two-part episode.
Possibly three, depends how long we prattle on for here.
But we're splitting it in much the same way as a Viking berserker may cleave the skull of a cowering militiaman just seconds before he was wondering what gate of hell this horrifying apparition had come from.
God, terrifying our listeners already with these Special Force soldiers here.
Exactly. Now, this leads us neatly onto our first Special Forces unit, the Viking Berserker.
Oh, now that is neat. I like that a lot.
Ah, yes, the Vikings. The more northern, cold climate-loving cousins of the pirate.
Oh.
Native to Dark Age Europe, who spent a lot of their time cruising in their dragon-headed longships, pillaging, burning any hapless peasant villages, killing the women and children, and raping the cattle
that happened to get in their way. That was the other way. I think that was the Welsh Saxons.
Yes. Sorry, they did it the other way around. Yes, the Vikings. Their brutal way of life is still a motivation today for many heavy metal music bands, in fact, amongst others.
True. Yes, when we think of a Viking, we always envisage them, don't we, Matt, as being quite hairy.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, because, well, they live in the cold climate, so
yeah.
Quite hairy, with long beards and longer braids of barbaric hair flying in the ocean breeze, apart from the ones who lived inland. Expect these guys to approach your unsuspecting village aboard intimidating monster-headed longships that you mentioned.
Yes, they're just dragon-headed, yes.
The modern, popular conception of the Viking warrior is one of a murderous savage, clad in animal skins and armour, running howling into battle. This conception probably owes more to literary tradition, Matt, than to historical fact, actually. It reflects not the ordinary Scandinavian warriors, but rather a special group of fighters known as the Berserks, or Berserkers.
Fierce men aboard fearsome boats. They had a reputation for raping, pillaging, and modern depictions will show them adorned in horned helmets.
Ah, now, hang on.
Yes. Although they never actually, Wayne, wore those, except for ceremonial occasions.
That's right, yeah.
The myth that they'd worn them at all times started with the Romans, which was subsequently unintentionally reinforced by some archaeologists digging up a Viking helmet near a couple of drinking horns.
Ugh.
And they assumed that they'd once been a single piece.
Oh, God. Well, surely such helmets were not only impractical, you know, they'd actually be dangerous, wouldn't they, if worn in combat, Matt? You know, a helmet with such a feature, those two big horns there, could be grabbed by an enemy who'd be able to pull off the horn.
Yeah.
You know, pull the wearer off balance.
Or pull off the Viking.
Well, you know, I don't know what these guys get up to when they're so adrenalised.
There's got to be a better way to take them down.
Yeah. Well, some depictions also suggest wing helmets as well. A bit weird, isn't it? They were actually worn by the Celts, the winged helmets, albeit only for religious ceremonies again. We also see the Vikings as heavily drinking party animals, enjoying a feast in the village hall. In fact, why don't we go back there now, Matt, and see what that might have been like for the casual observer? Okay, so we'll go back now.
We don't need the sound effects. Great. Okay.
Well, Matt Olaf, you know, I've been wanting to speak to you. Exactly. I'm worried about Lithensen the Butcher's state of mind.
What's wrong with him?
Well, now, don't tell the boys, but he seems so calm these days. Only last week, he killed three monks, but I can tell his heart wasn't really in it when he was horribly mutilating the bodies.
He does seem low-key. Wink, wink.
Let's have a wink, wink. It's a bit homoerotic for this meat hall. Can we have a nudge?
What did the Viking king name this place?
He called it Beef.
Oh,
for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway.
I see what you mean. He told me that he thought raping and pillaging was a good way to meet people.
That guy's my item. It's
crazy.
God, I can't get this guy. Anyway, look, let's just brighten the mood here, okay? We're drinking, we're having fun. So,
hey, thank you.
I've got a joke for you. Hey, Olaf. How many Vikings does it take to change a light bulb?
None. The light from the burning monastery is quite sufficient. Thank you.
Wow, that was a fascinating insight, isn't it, to how they must have lived, the Vikings. Anyway, we'll carry on.
So today, the word berserk is used to describe anyone in an irrational, agitated state of mind who cannot or does not control his or her actions. The meaning of the word originates with the Vikings, though, the Viking berserkers, the fierce warriors who were known for battling in an uncontrollable, trance-like fury.
Wow.
And were alleged to be able to perform seemingly impossible superhuman feats of strength.
Yeah, now, in medieval Norse and Germanic history, the berserkers were described as members of an unruly warrior gang that worshipped Odin, who of course was...
Norse, the supreme Norse deity, and Thor was his son.
Yes. Adding to their ferocious appearance, and in order to intimidate the enemy, they'd wear bear and wolf pelts when they fought, giving them the name berserker, meaning bear coat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one option of the berserker word.
Bear coat, yeah.
Yeah, that's in Old Norse. Mm-hmm. That said, the etymology of the term berserk is disputed, Matt.
Yeah.
It may mean bear's ark.
What? Balls hack?
No, bear, B-A-R-E, bear's ark, bear of shirt, and refer to the berserker's habit of going unarmoured into battle, just showing how tough they were.
Right.
I can see by your very gently raised eyebrow, Matt, you listeners can't see this, that you think this is a foolish trait.
But these were different times, I guess, and such demonstrations of bravery served the individual with great kudos amongst his fellow foaming mad Nordic nutters.
Yes, now, that's true, but I'm interested in knowing how these guys got themselves into this state.
Yes, right.
As someone who's been a highly strung individual in the past, you're probably best served to give us some background on how this process was undertaken.
Well, the way they did it in the past is little is known about the process, actually, of inducing their berserk fury. But we do know that it would have appeared to onlookers, it would have appeared
pretty
to
pretty intimidating stuff.
Yeah. The fury of the berserker would start with the chills and the teeth chattering and give way to a purpling of the face.
Getting angry.
As they literally became hot-headed.
That sounds like your sex face.
Yes, well, how would you know, Wayne? cumulated in a furious, uncontrollable rage accompanied by growls and howls.
Oh, God.
A bit like, Wayne, when you heard that Zayn Malik had left One Direction.
Why do you have to keep on bringing this up? Look, it will never be the same. Even if the new guy's really cute, it's just... Look, can you just stop waving that in my face all the time?
Look, move on, man. You gotta move on. Live for the now!
Just carry on.
The berserkers would also bite into their shield and gnaw at their skin before launching into battle, foam flying, indiscriminately injuring and maiming, killing anyone foolish enough to get into their path. Cool. Once they went, they were like a juggernaut, out of control, going forward.
Like a freight train.
Yeah.
Scary stuff. Now, dating back as far as the 9th century, the berserker Norse warriors were said to be able to do things, Matt, that normal humans could not. Strange, isn't it?
Well, it depends what it is.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, by saying doing things normal humans could not, I don't mean giving the live long and prosper Vulcan sign thing with your fingers.
Yeah, or lick their balls.
that's not a normal thing either. Did you know that? That's not a normal thing?
Yes, I did know that.
Let's just say that. Right, okay. According to ancient legend, Matt, the berserkers were indestructible. And no weapon could break them from their trance. They were described as being immune to fire and to the strike of a sword. Continuing on their rampage despite injury. Now, the Icelandic historian poet Snorri Sturluson Mm-hmm. I don't know how accurate that pronunciation is. Yep. He lived between 1179 and 1241 AD, so he's right on this. He knows what he's talking about. He wrote the following description of berserkers in his Ynglinga saga.
Sounds easy to say.
Yeah. Not sure if that's quite right, but I'm sure listeners haven't heard of it anyway, so what do they know? Okay, so here we go. His, that's Odin's, men rushed forward without armour, were as mad as dogs or wolves, bit at their shields, and were strong as bears or wild oxen, and killed people at a blow. But neither fire nor iron told upon them. It is believed that this account is partially true, and that their trance-like state actually prevented them from feeling pain until after the battle.
They were the ultimate shock troops. Once in combat, they killed, raped, pillaged with reckless abandon, to the point that some Norse sagas claimed that they could actually physically transform into ferocious beasts.
Jesus.
The berserkers' skill in battle made them much sought after as soldiers and royal bodyguards, but they were also feared and even hated by the fellow Vikings, which might surprise you.
Mm.
They could become so drunk with rage that they would inadvertently turn on their friends.
Oof.
They'd kill anything, basically, whether it was friend or foe.
Yeah.
And when not in combat, they often raped and murdered their allies to satisfy their bloodlust.
Well, these guys were psychos, weren't they?
Totally psychos.
The actual fit or madness the berserk experienced was known as something called berserkergang. This condition is described as follows. This fury, which was called berserkergang, occurs not only in the heat of battle, but also during laborious work. Men who were thus seized performed things which otherwise seemed impossible for human power. This condition is said to have begun with shivering, chattering of the teeth, a chill in the body, and then the face swelled and changed its colour and pallor. With this was connected a great hot-headedness, Matt and Wayne pointed out earlier, which at last gave over into a great rage, under which they howled as wild animals, bit the edge of their shields, and cut down everything they met without discriminating between friend or foe.
Bastards.
When this condition ceased, a great dulling of the mind, Matt, and feebleness followed, which could last for several days. That was a piece from Fabring there, Matt, that great piece of writing.
So Rolf Sagas speaks similarly of King Halfdan's berserks.
Okay, let's hear it.
On these giants fell sometimes such a fury that they could not control themselves, but killed men and cattle, whatever came in their way, and did not take any care for themselves. While this fury lasted, they were afraid of nothing, but when it left them, they were so powerless that they did not have half of their strength. But they were feeble, as if they had come out of a bed from a sickness. The fury would last for one day.
So that's Hrolf's saga from King Halfdan's piece of work there. It's fascinating. It really, really brings to life the time for me.
And you can get it as a downloadable audiobook from Audible.
Okay, so moving on. Just how the berserkers tapped into their famous anger is uncertain. They may have been connected to secretive cults devoted to the Norse gods Odin, so the rituals were likely mysterious, even to their contemporaries, Matt. Most scholars believe they simply worked themselves into a hypnotic trance, but others have speculated that they may have gotten blind drunk.
Probably unlikely, though, as that would have inhibited their ability to fight.
Yeah, so in that case, maybe it was, you know, a certain species of hallucinogenic mushroom.
Some researchers believe the berserkers simply worked themselves up into a self-induced hysteria before fighting. Others maintained that it was sorcery.
Oh,
whoa, a bit of magic, yeah. Black magic. The consumption of drugs or alcohol.
Probably the most likely.
Or even mental illness.
Also likely.
That accounted for their behaviour. Some botanists have claimed the berserkers' behaviour could have been caused by the ingestion of a plant known as bog myrtle.
Yeah, I've heard of
one of the main spices in Scandinavian alcoholic beverages. Wow. So worth going to Scandinavia and getting a beer made with that stuff.
Where can I get some of that? Well, other more esoteric theories suggest supernatural beliefs. Thank you. I also like more. For instance, some scholars have claimed that the Vikings believed in spirit possession, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And that berserkers were, in fact, possessed by the animal spirits of wolves or bears.
Well, good choice to be a bear rather than a vole or perhaps even an ant.
Indeed. Although ants are quite strong, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So, according to some theorists, berserkers learn to cultivate the ability to allow animal spirits to take over their body during a fight.
An example of animal totemism.
That's right. Also involved drinking the blood of the animal that they wish to be possessed by, actually. So probably not an ant.
Well, you wouldn't get much of a horned goblet filled with the blood of an ant.
No.
The berserkers were often said to take the animal totemism one step further and actually change into the sheeting beast.
Oh, change into bestial form, you mean?
Yes, yes, oh, okay. Exactly. Right. Or at least to assume the ferocious qualities of a wolf or a bear.
Yeah.
A guy called Veldafor in Egil's saga Skal a Grimsinor,
easy for you to say,
was spoken of as a shape changer.
Oh.
And Rolf's saga tells of the hero Bjarki, who takes the shape of a bear in battle. This next excerpt is from Eric, the Red, and other Icelandic sagas.
And men saw that a great bear went before King Hrolf's men. Keeping always near the king, he slew more men with his forepaws than any five of the king's champions. Blades and weapons glanced off him, and he brought down both men and horses in King Jorvard's forces. And everything which came in his path, he crushed to death with his teeth. So that panic and terror swept through King Jorvard's army.
Yeah, so, scary stuff there. In addition to their warlike activities within their communities, berserkers are characterised by their sexual excesses, carrying off wives, daughters and betrothed maids. In fact, a Norse writer called Saxo was particularly upset by this behaviour.
So outrageous and unrestrained were their ways that they ravished other men's wives and daughters. They seemed to have outlawed chastity and driven it to the brothel. Nor did they stop at married women, but also debauched the beds of virgins. No man's bridal chamber was safe. Scarcely any place in the land was free from the implants of their lust.
Saxo, Volume 1, page 118.
Yeah, so it just goes to show, doesn't it? These guys, they seem to be out of control. And you know, there's no doubt that these excesses of the berserker was the thing that ultimately resulted in their demise. In the end, these guys were too dangerous and unpredictable, even for the lords they served. And in 1015, Jarl Erika Hakonason,
well done indeed,
I think that's right, of Norway, outlawed berserkers. Mm. And Gragas, the medieval Icelandic law code, sentenced berserker warriors to outlawry.
Mm.
So then, by the 12th century, organised berserker war gangs had been completely disbanded. Typical. Yet another example of society's mentally ill being vilified, Matt.
Yes, yes, indeed. So with all we have just covered in mind, I guess the question we must ask ourselves is, would you want these guys, these berserkers, on your side in battle? How useful were they actually militarily, other than being flaming crazy?
Yeah, I think I understand what you're asking. Well, I'm not so sure, actually. I mean, they were clearly devastating in the right battlefield scenario, in the right place at the right time. But the fact they could slay foe and friend alike, you know, that raises a lot of red flags for me.
Mm.
Than perhaps you might find on a golf course, for example. And they could be more trouble than they're worth, I think, in a battle situation. And unless some of the old, admittedly fanciful-sounding stories are true,
shapeshifters and the like and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I prefer to have something a little more predictable on my side. You order them to do something and, you know, you're safe in the knowledge that they're going to go and do that.
Okay. Okay, well, you'll have to reserve, listeners, you'll have to reserve final judgment until we summarise our top 10. But we will move on to our second unit, the Germanic Ghost Warriors.
The Ghost Warriors, Night Raiders, or Harii.
Hooray!
Were the elite soldiers, well, they didn't say hooray when they turned up, I can tell you that. They were the elite soldiers of ancient Germanic tribes, such as the Cimbrii. Now, a lot of people, you know, when it comes to Roman names like this, it's got a double I at the end. Yeah. Some say Cimbri, some say Cimbrii. Just for consistency, we're going to say EI. That's how we're pronouncing this.
What, Cimbrii?
Cimbrii, yeah.
Okay.
Harii, that sort of thing. So, anyway, Germanic tribes such as the Cimbrii and the Teutons, who we all know, the name Harii, see, is the Roman name for these warriors, which is the name of a nocturnal Roman monster that would eat disobedient children. So you see where we're going with this? Mm-hmm. It's the link of the night already.
Yeah.
Now, these warriors painted their faces and bodies black, their shields and armour black, their weaponry black, and they would only attack during the darkest times at night, Matt.
I'm surprised the Goths haven't taken these guys on as their sort of symbol.
That's right. Well, you know, they're secretive, though. Maybe they don't know about them. It's been lost in time. But as they would attack people, they would emit inhuman roars and screams, thus giving the Romans incentive to give them the name of the child-eater monster.
The only time an opponent would realise where they were was when they got right into their faces and they could see the whites of the eyes.
Ooh.
Adding more to the idea that actual spirits were attacking them. The Germanic Ghost Warrior gained their fame due to night raids on the Roman armies and camps. They got their name Ghosts because their black painted weapons and bodies made them near invisible to the dancing shadows of the flaming torchlight.
Spooky.
For most armies, night is a time for withdrawing to the camp, having some mead, roasting a boar or two,
spit
and
roast.
Generally relaxing.
Have a spit roast. Soldiers
did that as well.
Yeah, not much.
For German night raiders, it was the time to black up, set up in search of an enemy, terrorise and slaughter.
Oh, well, generally speaking, these guys did not fight in open battles, but functioned as, you might expect, guerrilla fighters, mm-hmm. disrupting the enemy's movements in a certain area. They were reportedly extremely capable, Matt, with thrown projectiles like darts and even stones. And some Roman reports either claimed the Germanic warriors could throw a dart or spear as far as a bow could shoot an arrow.
Wow, okay.
Although that's probably a bit over the top, I don't imagine.
They might have, yeah.
They're probably maybe just saying to their superiors to say, the reason we ran away from these guys, they're superhuman, you know, they can throw a
spear. Yeah, exactly.
A
spear. It's kind of an excuse, isn't it? But it's,
yeah. Yeah. So, it's possible they could have had the aid of a spear thrower device, though, such as those used in Amazonian tribes today, perhaps.
Yeah. Tacitus refers to the Harii in his Germania writings.
For their part, the Harii, besides the military might, in which they surpass the peoples listed above, savage as they are, enhanced their inborn ferocity by trickery and timing. Their shields are black, their bodies stained with black. They choose dark nights for battles, and thus inspire terror with the shadowy horror of a ghostly army. None of their enemies can withstand that strange and, so to speak, hellish sight, for in every battle, the men are overcome first.
So, what Tacitus is saying here is that the defeat in a battle starts with the eyes. This is a fear-inducing sight. According to the Mattingly translation of this quote, let's take a look at how these individuals were equipped. Firstly, their long-range weapons included the Francisca throwing axe, ideal for surprise attacks.
You can imagine that, can't you? Just sort of like cartwheeling out of the night sky and thudding into things.
It's the chest of a Roman sentry on patrol.
Yeah.
Then the Harii would call on the Ger. The Ger was a long, flexible spear that was used with such good effect by these and other Germanic warriors that the Romans called the lands of the Germania as the land of the spearmen.
Oh, right, okay. So that's where Germany comes from, ladies and gentlemen. Land of the spearmen, apparently.
Mm.
So then, Once they got in close, Matt, they're in the camp now. Mm-hmm. The Hariyai would draw their short sword. This was a short, sturdy blade with a thick back edge and a sharp stabbing point.
Mm-hmm. It's a stabbing sword.
Yeah, it was made up close and personal. It was made out of steel and could happily shred the innards of anyone unfortunate enough to become impaled on that thing.
Just like a normal sword.
Yeah, basically. But this weapon was only 2 feet or so in length.
Makes it different.
But, you know, that close and personal fighting that you're going to have in a camp or in the confusion of a close situation like that at night, you know, it's perfect for that sort of thing. And they also boasted the good old-fashioned club, a timeless favourite since the first ape decided it would be a good idea to whack his love rival over the head with a tree branch. But the Germanian club, that had like a triangular edge running down its length, so that would increase the blow's effectiveness.
Jesus,
with skull-splitting efficiency. Ouch, match.
I can almost feel that caving in on my skull right now.
Well, try not to, don't.
For protection, the Hariyai wore leather-scale mail armour, along with iron and steel chainmail shirts. They covered these with animal hides, preferably a bear or wolf pelt, appropriately painted black, of course. Black. They carried excellent sturdy shields. The shields were so good, in fact, that even the Romans tried to copy them. If, you know, you're getting the Romans to copy
sturdy.
You've obviously got a pretty cool weapon there.
So, how do you feel about this unit then? I mean, in pitched battle, obviously, not entirely sure, because we don't really know how they operated at that time. But
to me, they sound a little bit like the Special Forces SAS. They go in dead at night, they take someone out, they create fear.
Maximum confusion.
They're gone, they think they're potentially otherworldly beasts, and they've got some pretty good weapons as well. So I would suggest they are...
They could be right up there.
Disruption tactics, fear-inducing, take away the morale of the army.
Well, yeah, so they're one of those units, I think, that if your opponent knows you have them, you know, then maybe it's harder for people to sleep at night. They know they get attacked. They've got to stay on guard all the time.
Be tired because, you know, they're restless. Yeah,
their reputation precedes them, and so very dangerous, very useful. But of course, we'll reserve judgment until we have our final top 10 breakdown. But now, we're going to transport you, the listeners, from the dark, brooding forests of Central Europe to the light, brooding, temperate zones of, I think it's around Mexico.
Anyway, Mexico!
Behold, the strange apparition that appears before your amazed eyes. You'd be right to be amazed, because these next warriors dated back to between the 14th and 15th century. They are the Aztec Shawn Ones.
Yes, the Shawn Ones were the most respected and prestigious of the Aztec warrior ranks. The Aztecs, as we know, were a society who were driven by what we perceive today as mysticism.
Yeah, very spiritual.
In fact, wasn't it the Aztecs who predicted the 2012 apocalypse?
Well, that, like many predictions of doom, turned out to be rubbish. come to think of it, the Aztecs didn't have a very good track record of predictions because they sure didn't see the Spanish coming.
Wait.
No? Too soon?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you know.
Well, before
300 years, 400 years.
Before we take a closer look at the Shawn One warrior, let's have a quick recap on the society in which they functioned. So the Aztecs were not a single society or nation, but many separate tribes that shared a common language and culture. It just so happened that the tribe in power during the Spanish conquest was the Mexica tribe, the country's eventual namesake, in fact.
Ah, very interesting. So at its pinnacle, Aztec culture had rich and complex mythological and religious traditions, as well as reaching remarkable architectural and artistic accomplishments. In warfare, they tended to prefer to catch their enemies rather than to kill them, so they could be enslaved or subjected to a fate worse than death. Death by sacrifice. A very disheartening prospect for the enemies of the Aztecs. If you've seen the film Apocalypto, you'll know what I mean.
Oof. Well, if you can bear it, let's go back and see how these people may have viewed their sacrifices.
You know, Tutankhamun, I've been thinking.
Fool, you will anger the gods.
No, this may be a little paranoid.
Fool, you'll anger the gods again.
Oh, look, just listen.
I know we sacrifice to prevent the world from ending.
Yes.
But it seems an awful waste of human life to me.
Yeah.
Do we really need to practice human sacrifice anymore?
Practice? No. We're good enough at it already.
Oh, you know what? If I was somebody else, I'd hate to be conquered by me.
Listen, you won't conquer anyone thinking like that. What's wrong with you? Do you want to anger the gods or something?
No, I don't want to anger the gods.
Well, I'm not sure I like your thinking. Now listen, you're on your sacrificial training course today, so put those thoughts out of your head and concentrate. Now, first, choose your victim. Okay. There's a selection of lower caste prisoners there. You see there? Pick one.
Okay, well, that guy there, he looks pretty low caste and he looks pretty downtrodden. Hey, you! I've chosen you.
Me? Oh, have I won something? Take them up the steps to the top of the pyramid. Phew! I'll be dead by the time I reach the top.
Oh, I hope not. I'll be getting graded today.
Tie the victim onto the curved altar.
You're so gentle. You're a man after my own heart.
Well, that's true.
Now, take an obsidian knife and carefully open the chest cavity.
Okay. Let's open up this chest now, Mr. Victim.
This must be my treasure chest. At last, my prize. Those steps were worth it after all.
Reach inside the chest and pluck out the still beating heart.
Have a heart?
Don't worry, I will.
Now, offer the heart to the sun god, and he will bestow adequate rain for the forthcoming season, blah, 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 and so on, ad nauseam.
Very well, I will do. Accept this gift of life and blood,
that's
great
it.
Sun god.
Yes.
And bestow your rain upon our kingdom, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Now, chant after me. Excellent, excellent work. Okay, so now I have some corn I want to grow in my garden. That equates to 15 prisoners. Okay, you get those in a minute. And also, the wife's having a dinner party a week Tuesday. I want that to go really well. So that'll be another 12 prisoners executed, heart out, and so on. Good.
27 prisoners. Okay, next.
Good man.
Yeah, strange bunch. But the Aztecs have always fascinated me. I first read about them in history, actually, in secondary school or high school, for you Americans listening. I don't know what they have in other countries. I couldn't think of anything more fascinating to see than the Aztec structures, you know. Unless it was the pyramids of Egypt or perhaps Rome or something else. I dreamed of wandering through a jungle and coming up moss-covered ruins.
Surely you mean coming upon moss-covered ruins?
I know what I mean. Don't spoil the fantasy. I really like those ruins.
Oh. Okay. They were nice ruins and possibly added to a little bit by Wayne. Didn't you plan to travel to Mexico a few years back to see them, though? You said it would have been a trip of a lifetime. The climate, the beaches, the food, the unique historical architecture and the culture...
Yes, but in the end, I decided I didn't want to be killed by bandits. That's not racist. Lovely country, of course. If we have any Mexican government officials listening, you have to sort out the bandit problem. Or am I thinking of Jamaica? Anyway, move on.
Yeah. Back to the historical podcast. Yeah. Based on those ruins, the Aztecs may have seemed like mythical, highly spiritual and powerful beings with a vision of life, cosmology, and an insightful knowledge of the natural universe.
That's true, yeah.
But in fact, they were, as indeed in the case with most empires, selfish people who used their superior power to inflict unspeakable levels of pain upon others to promote their misguided beliefs.
Deja vu.
They built their temples, buildings, and structures to the benefit of an elite group of leaders. These elite leaders know their military from their apples or even their bananas. And they use the military as their enabling tool in conquering other tribes and areas. Over time, the Aztec Shorn Ones rose to the top of the Aztec military order. But why were the warriors so prized, Mr. Bridgman?
Well, the Aztec army was composed of various classes and ranks. From this, they built a hierarchy structure to their army. The majority of the army was built around commoners. They had sort of basic training of fighting behind them.
Grunts.
And, yeah, grunts. They were out of the warrior ranking system completely. Mm-hmm. Cannon fodder. The elite of the army was constructed from Aztec nobility, whose ranking in the army was denoted by their achievements. So these were the professional warriors whose full-time occupation was battle and war, trained for overtime.
A bit like the old Spartans.
Yeah, all of their spare time was dedicated to training and a life of violence.
Definitely
not something
like the
Spartans. We can really relate to today, yeah. Obviously.
So let's just understand a little bit more about the rank system within this army. So for a commoner to rise in status, he would have to prove himself in battle. And one of the main means for doing this was to capture enemy warriors. Aztecs were known not to seek to kill their enemies as such, but instead, if possible, to bring them back alive, to be used as sacrifices in their ceremonies. They need more rain, a nice dinner party, etc., etc. This would be a core part of the training for any young man, but he would have to capture prisoners to show his skill in battle and not to kill them. Once a certain number of enemies had been captured by an individual, they would then be on their way to becoming a prestigious eagle or jaguar warrior. This was the first, but not limited to nobility. So let's take a look at the different ranks.
Well, the first type of Aztec warrior in these ranks was the eagle warrior. Now, the eagle warriors were the scouts of the Aztec military, and also handy fighters too. So as you might, you equate this to eagle soaring around, mm-hmm. good eyes, looking at things, they're scouts. So they were the eyes, ears, the messengers who would find the information necessary to lead and strategize and attack. Now, these warriors often wore helmets adorned with eagle feathers and heads.
Obviously.
Yeah, and they also adorned their armor with feathers too, actually, and carried brightly colored shields. Although, yes. I'm not sure if that was a great choice for scouts.
Yeah, it might be a bit of a giveaway, mightn't it?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. They could have done this. Maybe if the enemy saw them, these guys would just sort of scratch in the dirt with their feet, make cawing noises and sort of flap their arms in the hope they looked like an eagle that was close rather than a man who was far away, dressed up.
Yeah, well, maybe, but let's not theorise, shall we? Yeah. Let's stick to the facts as we've decided to embellish
them
a little bit.
Sorry, yeah, of course, yes.
Okay, so the second rank of the Aztec warrior class was the Jaguar Warrior, one maybe we've all heard of. The Jaguar Warrior was considered to be the all-out fighting troop, the full-time warrior, the brute force of the Aztec army. They wore jaguar skins over their heads and their faces, peering out beneath the jaguar's mouth.
Yeah, I see the significance there too. You see, the jaguar, powerful, agile, strong, dangerous with tooth and claw.
You could just imagine you're going through the jungle of Mexico and you see some rustling in the bushes and you think it's a jaguar, and then it sort of raises itself up and there's a man there staring under there with a big sort of obsidian axe.
Wild-eyed.
It would absolutely terrifying, wouldn't it?
Wild-eyed, gnashing teeth, and then he sort of launches himself at you like a jaguar might, screaming a blood-curdling scream, weapon raised in the air. Well, it wouldn't be a good look to come up on.
You would absolutely be laying down a scent.
The jaguar could follow, no doubt.
Yeah.
So who's next?
Right, then you have the Otomis. The Otami were highly respected for their vicious fighting style. It's not clear whether the Otami were a true type of Aztec rank or whether it was actually a band of outsiders who fought alongside the Aztecs. Perhaps they were a particularly tough tribe who were inhumed into the main army. Whether their origin were considered allies, basically fierce fighters.
So they had their prestige and they were in their place in the rank. So now we reach the subject of our best ancient special forces candidate here in the Aztec army. And this is the Shorn Ones. Now, they sound dangerous already, don't they?
Yeah.
The Shorn Ones were the most respected and prestigious Aztec warrior rank.
Mm-hmm.
As is the case with all Aztec military ranks, these Aztec warriors dressed in a manner unique to their rank. So, let's have a look at these guys then. The Shorn Ones had, surprise, surprise, cleanly shaved head.
Well, you could have been a Shorn One, and not just for your head.
Due to my physical prowess, you mean?
Well, the fact you've got you You like to shave?
All right, yes. No, not that head. But they could have like a single long braid extending from the back of their head as well.
Yeah.
Flying around. They painted their faces with vivid colours to show their ferocity. Maybe the first instance of face painting, but not the sort you get at a fair for kids.
No. Yeah.
And they were renowned for not taking a backward step in combat.
Now, not every Aztec warrior could or would be a member of an elite Shawn One division, partly because entry required the warrior to show incredible skill and bravery that most warriors just would not be able to achieve.
Okay.
The Shawn Ones would have to capture many sacrifices on the battlefield, a common task for members of the elite Aztec order, like the Otamis and the Eagle and Jaguar Warriors.
They're all at it.
Yeah, but in addition...
Competing, I suppose, weren't they, for these captives? Yeah.
Yeah, but in addition, it's reported you would have to perform 20 brave deeds to gain membership of the Shawn Ones.
Right.
So, you know, there's, you know... 20 things in battle you need to do without being killed yourself before you get into these experienced warriors.
People notice as well, so you probably need more than that.
Yeah.
So, as with any of the high-ranking orders within the Aztec army, the warriors accepted into the ranks of the Shawn Ones were granted various privileges. So, just like the Otamis, the Shawn Ones were granted a house in the Emperor's Palace. Those houses were separated into the commoners and the nobility, actually, within the Shawn One orders in that place. In addition, the prestige of being a member of the Shawn Ones would also raise your personal status and maybe raise a few other things, Matt, in general Aztec society. So commoners would respect and revere you as one of the mightiest Aztec warriors alive. And I'm sure you would attract a little glance or two from the Aztec ladies.
Or maybe a little bit of wildlife as well would glance appreciative as you walk past in your skins, or whatever it is you wore. So, anyhow, what do these guys look like? The Shawn... Nice segment, you see, that's what I said to that. The Shawn Ones were highly visible on the battlefield.
Sorry, I've just got to stop. I'm not really happy that you're sort of suggesting that these great warriors were fans of bestiality.
Sorry, I wasn't. I was only implying that maybe the beast liked them, not the other way around.
Oh, right, because of the outfits, right.
Yes, okay, yeah. Okay, so the Shawn Ones were highly visible on the battlefield. You know, these guys weren't running away. In Aztec society, the higher your status, the more flamboyant your dress and style could be. So the Shawn Ones were typical of this. So Wayne, you're walking through the jungle, a Shawn One comes up in front of you.
Yeah.
What do you see before your eyes?
Oh, God. Well, tell me. What am I looking at?
Imagine yourself facing him now.
Okay.
He's 5'8". Not as tall as you'd expect, but this
average,
was at old
times,
in those times, yeah. He's tanned. He's got a scarred physique of a middleweight boxer.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm not attracted to him.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. Okay.
Very muscular, very strong. His steely eyes peer hungrily at you from the frame of his shaven head.
I should point out I'm fully clothed as well here.
He's got green feathered headdress on.
Yeah, okay.
His mohawk hair style spills down his back in a long braid.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he's adorned with necklaces, gold earrings, and of course, weaponry.
Okay, well, don't let the necklaces and gold earrings spoil the image, because, Matt...
Well...
Now, let's say you're with me here.
Okay.
And we've both seen this guy now.
And I'm also dressed in a... possibly as a Jaguar warrior.
Okay, right. Well, look at him. At his side hangs his Kuahololi.
Oh, dear. I hope he's got that sheathed.
Well, that is that was a mace made of wood with a ball at the end.
That's what I mean. I hope he's got it sheathed.
Yeah. It's a mace. So it's got a heavy sort of like, you know, club at the end of this mace thing. So it could be used to smash and crush. Now... Mm-hmm.
Useful if you're making a mojito.
Look at this guy, Matt. Mm-hmm. You've got to concentrate on this because you don't know what he's going to do. His hand flexes around the shaft of a 7-foot spear.
Right, okay.
It doesn't have a small point as many spears you might be familiar with, but has a blade a foot wide made of sort of smaller stone blades, right? So you've got a big sort of paddle.
And these are made of obsidian stone as well, which is outrageous.
Yeah, obsidian around the edge there.
Sharp,
so very, very sharp. Now, these spears were known to pierce the Spanish armour.
Jesus.
And were actually sharp enough that the warriors could use them to shave with.
Wow, okay.
And they were called postopili. Now, He thrusts his spear butt into the ground, Matt.
Yeah.
Cricks his neck and starts to walk towards you, because this time I'm behind a tree now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I'm now, sitting there basically cacking my pants. He's right, trying to do not that. To. Still trying to keep his eye, but deep down I'm cacking my pants.
Yeah, okay. Well, the bright yellow and gold of his Lachowitz war suit and terrifying green face on his shield is mesmerising, yeah.
It's very pretty. Yeah.
You see his red and white pamital back banner. So that's like a tall and slim
right
banner attached to his back, you know, festooned with stuff.
Yeah.
Start to shift from side to side as he issued a piercing shriek, bares his teeth like an animal, and sprints towards you.
Bloody hell. Well, you know you will not give up. You can't make him run.
No.
You must beat him off or die. Your eyes widen as he raises what looks to be a wooden sword with a black stone embedded in the blade edge.
Obsidian again here.
This is the...
The Machaquil.
The Machaquil. This sword is made from wood.
Yeah, since this guy saw you, Matt, he's got his wood out. What are you going to do?
This wood is oak, by the way. Oh. Now, this sword is 3 to 4 inches wide and about 3 to 4 foot long.
Yeah.
The two-handed version of this might be slightly wider and as tall as a person.
Wow.
Embedded in the edges was ultra-sharp obsidian.
That's a volcanic stone, of course.
Yeah, or flint.
Yeah.
The
Machaquil
were incredibly strong, and the Spanish claim they could chop the head off a horse with one blow.
Wow.
If you've seen the film Last of Mohicans, that guy, the dad of the guy in The Last Mohicans, uses that.
Yeah.
And he's lethal with it.
And really, just talking about that obsidian that they have embedded in the edges of their weapons, I saw an image when I was researching this, actually. I saw an image online and it showed a steel scalpel alongside an obsidian scalpel. They use these things for surgery. And the steel scalpel, sort of like under a microscope, had jagged edges tapered to the point. But the obsidian version was just totally smooth. And it can be as little as one atom thick.
Wow.
I mean, this is...
That is seriously...
Seriously sharp.
So do they actually use that in preference to normal scalpels for certain operations?
I don't know, actually.
Okay.
About the scalpel side, but it helped them with capturing people. Because the cuts that these weapons made were so clean, they didn't bleed out as much as they would have done if you had, like, a jagged cut from a Spanish steel saw blade or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it could allow them to take them back, patch them up, and whip the old heart out. You know?
Yeah, and get a good harvest.
Yeah, so...
As a consequence.
So, Matt, anyway, this guy, he's coming for you. Now, normally such a colourfully dressed individual you'd probably welcome with open arms at some of the venues you go to, but in this case, you know, you turn and flee from this horrifying, screaming apparition, hoping to outrun the burdened warrior who's carrying weapons, isn't he?
Do I perhaps admit a fearful scream myself?
If it makes you feel better, you go ahead and do that.
Okay,
right.
I would. Yes.
This guy, Matt, you think you can get away? I mean, you've done the occasional marathon and triathlon and so on. You feel you're pretty fit, you know. But this guy, he trains full time for this. He trains full time for fighting and running down and capturing foes, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So you feel a searing... Sorry to do this, Matt, but you feel a searing pain. Chop your legs from under you and you tumble into the dirt, screaming in agony as your hamstrings are cut through.
Yeah, well, that's going to take a while to mend. I probably won't be doing any long-distance running for probably a couple of weeks.
Get your money's worth out of the NHS.
Yeah.
But your legs are flopping uselessly as your muscles spasm.
Okay.
And you'll have a fine view this evening, Matt, a fine view from atop the sacrificial slab on the Pyramid of Cholula.
A terrible tale indeed of my own demise,
Wayne. Just a story.
You know? But I would use my mobile phone to call up the police. They would turn up, taser his arse, and at the very least, he would get 7 years for wounding with malicious intent.
Well, I see, yeah. Well, maybe that's what took their empire down. Not the Spanish at all, but effective policing.
I guess we will never truly know.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that the Aztec warriors went to war in order to expand their empire.
Well, no-brainer.
Yeah, and to meet the needs they had to provide sacrifices for their beliefs and their rituals.
Yeah.
Harvest, dinner party, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
A religious justification for murder? Who knows? Who would have thought it? Therefore, war was a necessary part of the Aztec life.
Well, it was? Well, why is that?
Well, the Aztecs were very strong with their opinions on war and sacrifice. They would supply blood to make sure the sun returned.
Ah.
The sacrifices were a convenient way of doing this.
And who are we to say this wasn't the right thing to do, Matt? I mean,
It's not proven, but it's best to have all your bases covered when it comes to ensuring the sun comes up and ensuring appeasement of any gods in general who may happen to be taking an interest. But the big question, would you have these guys in your army, Matt, when compared to the others we're talking about?
Well, I will reserve the judgment on that to the podcast's conclusion. What I will say is that they are fierce dudes and they are poorly armoured, though. And their weapons may not hold up against the European counterpart.
Yes, although, as we said, there were stories of Spanish armour being breached by some of these weapons. But, you know, these were the weapons, these were their top warriors. And the Spanish, with their steel, they cut through these guys with no problem at all. So,
yeah. Mind you, it'd be interesting to see what a Shorn one would do in a battle against a berserker.
Right,
you know, both of them have not got a lot of armour. Yeah. Both of them pretty skilled.
Yeah, and these guys would be agile, fast, you know, got this berserker blundering around, roaring, dribbling. Well, let's not go into it now. We'll have that for later. So, well, actually, we've only got through our first three warriors in our allotted time.
Yeah.
So this could well extend out to three podcasts, I think.
So I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And, you know, again, Wayne, we've got the email address, haven't we? We've got historical@hotmail.com is our email address, so please do write to us.
Please do write
and,
to us.
And, you know, we're going to work on podcast number two, and we'll probably cover another three. Maybe we'll get four in the next podcast.
And
so,
just to say that we've also got a podcast about a little fellow called, had a few issues, called Vlad the Impaler.
Yes.
Now, we may insert that between some of the other podcasts to break it up a little bit for the ancient special forces. We'll see how we go with that. If you've got any suggestions yourself about how that wants to go, if you're desperate to
a bit of
part
lad.
Two, well, actually, if you're desperate to hear part two of the ancient special forces straight away, you can't wait, then let us know. We'll try and get out to you as soon as possible.
Yeah.
I'm thinking probably about 4 to 6 weeks for the next one. I know you guys have been asking us to get these out sooner, and we're going to try and do that for you. So
it leaves me to say, until next time, live long and prosper.
Bye.